those hobbies that, you know, yuppies do.
Mm. Like polo.
Like polo. And we're working on that. We're working toward polo.
I don't think it's quite as upper crust as polo.
Just saying. Before we begin, a bit of housekeeping. Please rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Additionally, if you have anyone sitting near you with their phone out right now, please take their phone and subscribe to the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Trachtenberg Wonkcast, a policy roundtable where we dive deep into policy issues and discuss all things wonky. Let's introduce the panel today.
Madam Brooks, I'm a first-year MPP concentrating on defense policy.
I'm Elizabeth Moorhead. I'm also a first-year MPP concentrating on social policy.
Gus Thomas Coyne, first-year MPP focusing on urban policy.
Haley Dunn, first-year MPP regular contributor. I'm focusing on criminal justice and anti-poverty.
And I am Nathan Rupp, in-house regulator. That's it. All right. So our first segment is something that we like to call Below the Fold, where we briefly talk about important policy issues that may have been overlooked due to the bold headlines. So who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
All right.
Okay. So mine has to do with criminal justice, and it was an interesting article I read in The Atlantic about a new court that's being opened this summer in Chicago. It's called the Restorative Justice Community Court. It's being backed by a Justice Department grant for 2 years. So the purpose is to let certain young people, and they're defining that as 18 to 26, who are charged with nonviolent felonies or misdemeanors, typically burglary, property damage, and theft, to have other options than incarceration if found guilty. So the aim is to focus on looking at the harm from crime on the neighborhood and the victims and see if there's a more productive way to redress wrongs than would be typical in a normal court. So some of these approaches could include mediation or locally focused restitution. And the court will bring together the defendant, the victim or victims, and the members of the community to find sentencing options that benefit everyone. So restorative justice is not a new idea, but this court will be run entirely on the restorative justice model. And the organizers hope that this can help ameliorate the distrust of the criminal justice system and allow offenders to redress and move on from mistakes without crippling their futures from felony convictions, for example. So this is basically a test case, and so it's going to be really interesting to see how this works out. Can these courts that are specifically designed just to do restorative justice improve outcomes for offenders, victims, and the communities? And if it does work, how can we maybe implement that on a wider level? So it's great. I think I was encouraged to see that our Justice Department was giving them a grant to do this, and I think it's going to be really great to hopefully see what kind of benefits that could have and whether we could widen that to other places in the country.
Excellent. Thank you. Who's next?
I'll go next. So I'm going to talk about how THAAD is, you know, becoming operational in South Korea.
What's THAAD?
THAAD is, I promise it's not a fraternity, bro. It's it's stands for Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. It's a missile defense system. We put this in South Korea to defend against a nuclear strike from North Korea, basically. So this is just becoming operational. It's in the initial stages of being operational. There are some political and technical problems with THAAD. The political problems are China doesn't like it because China feels that THAAD is directed against them to degrade their capability to strike against us. And the South Koreans don't like it because they don't want to increase, you know, tensions with China. They like to be on good terms with China and the United States. But it's become a necessity because of North Korea, because they're acting up. This has been a big, big topic in the South Korean presidential election, but it was brought up in the sense that Donald Trump said that the South Koreans should pay for more of their defense, they should share more of the burden, and he suggested that they should pay for THAAD. But McMaster, H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, came out and said that we would be paying for it, the United States would be paying for THAAD.
I'll go next. So mine focuses on, it was actually in a headline yesterday that Trump was ending Michelle Obama's girls' education program, which is ironically called Let Girls Learn. So that's stopping, apparently. What it was supposed to do was help adolescent girls attain a quality education to help them reach their full potential, but it was globally focused, so because 62 million girls are not in school globally, so it did a lot of work that was not only in the U.S., and it was an intergovernmental initiative, but it was ran primarily at the Peace Corps. So the Peace Corps sent out an email yesterday saying that moving forward, they will not continue to use the Let Girls Learn brand or maintain a standalone program, but aspects of the Let Girls Learn program will continue. Although the brand name will no longer be used.
Too controversial to use that name.
And interestingly, she also said that Let Girls Learn had several years of funding already backed. So they were hopeful that it would continue, but because of the election, it will not. Kind of just over there dismantling the Obama's legacy.
One girl's education at a time.
And, and you know, learning like we do.
And I've got one, and it actually involves a report out today by Consumer Reports focusing on the impact of the ACA on bankruptcies. In particular, they have seen that bankruptcies have decreased since by 50% since the implementation of the ACA. Consumer Reports charted out how bankruptcies grew to a peak in 2010 of 1.5 million. And following the implementation, every year it has decreased down to now about 770,000. And that decrease has been continuous since first the Affordable Care Act was rolled out and then when it was also fully implemented in 2012. The primary bankruptcies during this time were medical bankruptcies, and that these have been greatly reduced since implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
So my below the fold comes from the great state of Louisiana. So after a rocky week in the Louisiana House, a new bill has potentially reached some ears. Well, it's not a House bill, I guess. It's Senate Bill 92. What this bill does is it allows victims of domestic violence to take civil action against their abusers. Additionally, it adds provisions for non-married couples. So they are also protected under this law, which they have not been. And so this change is not unheard of. Other states have passed similar provisions, but as someone who cares deeply for the state of Louisiana, I'm very pleased that Senate Bill 92 is making its way through the state legislature. That being said, right now is a fiscal session. Louisiana is one of those states that separates sessions by topic, so this bill cannot come up for a vote right now, but it's helpful that it's getting some traction before it'll even come up. So hopefully when the time comes for Senate Bill 92 to get voted on, people will have heard about it and told everyone, all their Congress people in Louisiana, please vote for Senate Bill 92. That's my below the fold. We'll be back after a quick break. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us. We'll be turning to our guest, Thomas, now, and he'll be talking to us about immigration and Detroit.
Yeah, thanks. So I've been looking at the city of Detroit and specifically Mexican migration to Detroit. So the city has a long history of migration, and in particular, the neighborhood names have strongly reflected that, even if they've been pretty on the nose. So for example, there's Greektown, of people from Greece previously, Corktown, Irish, Poletown, Chaldean Town, and Mexican Town among them.
There's a place called Mexican Town in Detroit?
There is.
That's actually its like...
It is actually its name.
So like if you enter the neighborhood and you see the sign...
It'll say that like...
It would say like
Welcome to Mexican Town.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And Mexican Town actually comprises one of five neighborhoods in southwest Detroit that is primarily... either people who are foreign-born from Mexico or are descendants of people from Mexico. The numbers within there are that people of Mexican descent make up about 48% of the total population. And so migration of Mexican immigrants to Detroit has been particularly interesting to people in the media following both Detroit's bankruptcy and also pushes to draw people into the city. And the ability of that community to grow despite the city's bankruptcy and population decline is, I think, particularly interesting. And there's a couple reasons that this might be the case. Two of these reasons are like existing things within the city. One is that Detroit's previously had a really high foreign-born population. Back in the 1850s, about as high as like 45%, and even in about the 40s, still about 30% of the city. That has since declined and came down to a low point of about 3% the year 2000. It has since rebounded up to about 6%, which is not a great increase, but a big increase overall. And the other things that the city has are also existing welcoming organizations within the city, including a number of Southwest Detroit-based nonprofits, both community organizations, neighborhood centers.
Briefly, why is the population of Detroit going down, and why is the population of Mexican immigrants to Detroit going up? Do you have a, I mean, like, I know that's a big question.
Yeah.
So there's, tell us why people act the way they do.
So there's a couple of reasons. There's big problems with the city of Detroit and segregation. That's been a long-standing problem since probably the Great Migration. And with the city's white residents fleeing the city and segregating themselves in the suburbs, which was also drawn by the way that the city's structured. The other is that the auto industry and its turmoil over the past probably century and its cyclical nature of work has also drawn people out of the city as the auto industry has slowly moved further and further out of the city, and not just into neighboring suburbs but into other states and other countries as well.
And as far as the influx then, like, what is drawing people there if everyone else is leaving?
Yeah, so there,
particularly Mexican immigrants.
Yeah, so there are some theories about this actually. So one is chain migration, and that's if people from one region move to another country, they want to move to places where there's family, there's friend connections, there's people who will be able to get them jobs.
Is the city itself doing anything particular? Are there other policies in place on the city level that are making it particularly hospitable? Or is this more a grassroots support?
So it actually started out as grassroots support. It started out as, you know, these nonprofits like La Sed or the Southwest Detroit Business Association, Business Development Association, working on services to help welcome immigrants into the city. And the city actually adopted a framework that was first founded in Nashville, which is the Welcoming Cities Initiative/Coalition.
Is that similar to like a sanctuary, quote unquote sanctuary city? Or
similar, I would say probably. Almost all sanctuary cities are welcoming cities. Not necessarily all of the welcoming cities are sanctuary cities.
I see.
But all have the common goal of wanting to bring migrants into cities in the United States.
I was just going to say, what are the policy implications that you see from this influx of immigration?
So Detroit's kind of a special case. In general, sometimes cities, when they have influxes of people, can see in the short term, I want to be very careful about this here, in the short term, can see wages decrease, and sometimes they can also have problems of like social cohesion and people getting along with one another.
Mm-hmm.
This is lessened in cities like Detroit, thankfully, where there's been a long history of migration. Theorists have theorized and seen that cities that have these long histories are maybe more adept at bringing people in and welcoming them.
So do you think that the living conditions are better for foreign-born in Detroit than in other major cities? Like,
not necessarily. There are some challenges that the city has. One of the costs of living in the city, despite Detroit's already kind of low cost of living, is increased because you have to have a car. So there's one bridge, a tunnel, and then also a train connector between Detroit and Canada. And with this comes increased attention from ICE. Despite the large number of Canadians that might otherwise come into the city, and you might expect ICE to focus on them, I believe the majority of people deported from Detroit are actually of Mexican origins.
What percentage are illegal?
That's a good question. So the overall estimates, the overall estimates I've seen of undocumented people or undocumented migrants is about 130,000 total. I haven't seen statistics that break that down to the city level in Detroit.
Do you think that Detroit supports the ideals that the administration has been putting forward?
No. And I don't think...
Thank you.
I don't think in general the state of Michigan has been either.
So one of the things that people give the Trump administration for is there has been a net decrease of immigration, particularly from Mexico, since he has taken office. And so since that is the case, it seems that the federal rhetoric is overshadowing some of these state level policies. Other things that the cities can do, should they be, firstly, do you think they should be more welcoming? And if so, how do you think the city should be responding to the immigrant population they have?
I've always thought it's been very important that we live up to our national ideals, like the Statue of Liberty. So welcoming immigrants, and myself being a grandchild of immigrants, I think that's something that we as a nation should be doing. Whether it's city, small town, mm-hmm. that's something we should be doing to welcome people.
As for city-level policies, what can they be doing if the idea is to foster a sense of belonging, if that is the intention?
Yeah, what does welcoming mean? Like, what makes a city welcoming?
Yeah, so that's just the name that they give their overall programs. So they hope, so in welcoming cities, they hope to coordinate services at a city level to try to make it easier for migrants to access city services, to get community services at neighborhood level organizations, to access like government documents, loans, and things like that that are geared towards migrants and also just general citizens, but with a particular focus on making it accessible to migrants who might not necessarily have a background in English language or a background in the community.
So I know in LA there's been a lot of tension because of increased ICE activity. The LAPD has actually asked ICE to stop calling themselves the police, right? So how is the relationship between ICE and the city government in Detroit, or even the police department in Detroit? Is it as bad as in LA, or is it better? Is it somewhere in between?
I would say it's somewhere in between. The police chief for the city of Detroit has kind of gone back and forth on whether they want to cooperate with ICE. And part of it is a logistics and realities of the city of Detroit thing. So focusing on things such as immigration, not one of their biggest priorities.
And I actually want to open this question up then to everybody. I think that you brought up a good question about the interaction between federal enforcement and local enforcement. And I just think that, I'm opening this question to everybody. What should be the interaction between federal and local policy, or particularly enforcement policies on the city level? I know you've already spoke to it, Thomas. I was wondering if anyone else had any ideas about that.
I think it makes sense to, within reason, allow local enforcement agencies to focus on the crimes that they think are doing the most damage to their communities. And based on what you said, it doesn't seem that enforcing immigration and deportation is necessarily key to Detroit's, health and well-being, and could actually be harming it. So I would say that I think ICE should not try to interfere or otherwise undermine the efforts of local enforcement. But I'm not an expert on this. But that would be my hunch, would be to say the local enforcement agencies have a better idea of what's most important for them to handle.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to enforce the laws that are on the books, but resources are finite, and you can only do so much. And with that in mind, ICE in particular, should be focusing on deporting criminals, not deporting people who haven't done anything wrong. They should not be the priority. If resources...
Well, isn't crossing into the country illegally a crime in its own right?
It is, but like I said, you can only do so much. There's only so many resources. You should focus on the dangerous criminals, the people who are trafficking drugs or are engaging in theft or have murdered somebody or have done some crime that's more serious than simply immigrating illegally, which I think is a problem. If you should, if you're going to come here, you should come here legally. You should not come here illegally. The government should be enforcing the law in general. It shouldn't be trying to enforce particular laws. Like it's, I mean, of course you want to prioritize the kind of crime, but you don't want to prioritize who's committing the crime, right? You want to try and prevent and catch murderers. You don't want to just target like murderers of a particular race.
Yeah, I think there's
background.
A word for that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, discrimination.
I think that's the one I was
right.
thinking of, yeah.
I mean...
But this, to me, raises a bigger question, which may be outside the scope of this conversation, but I'm going to raise it anyway. The issue of federalism.
Mm-hmm.
That this problem seems to be state and local level policy being at odds with the federal law. And how do we reconcile this issue? I understand, potentially as an opposition party, you can feel that you now like the federal doctrine because the federal law is something you don't agree with. And so federalism now seems to be something the Democrats are on board with. But my question is how, from a policy standpoint, how do you reconcile these two issues if you're trying to, you can't break the law. You can't say, federal law doesn't matter here. But at the same time, you also have to, should you respect the local level policy? Like, does Detroit being a welcoming city, does that matter? Should that matter? And how should that interact with the federal law? And how can we reconcile federalism when maybe you don't agree with the federal law?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
I don't know that I can answer that sufficiently, unfortunately. But I can illustrate it at least a little bit. So... the state of Michigan has always had a very contentious relationship with the city of Detroit. Part of it is a rural-urban divide. Part of it is a big city and rest of the state divide.
Mm-hmm.
However, in this one case where the federal government's doing one thing and the city's trying to do another, this is one place where the state government, despite being a different party, so the state government controlled by Republicans, the city by Democrats, at the state and city level, they're actually on the same level. And the state government went so far as to try to call for about 50,000 visas to be issued just for people to come to Detroit, which didn't happen, but the state government was at least trying to help this happen, which I think illustrates some big odds and big differences in how the Michigan Republicans in this case are working with the city and in opposition to the federal government.
Well, I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear. The local governments and state governments have to respect federal law. They can't break it, but they don't have to help enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if the federal government wants to enforce the law, it should go in there and enforce it itself, or it should get the local and state government on board. That's the only way. That's the way federalism works. That's the way the system's designed.
Well, on that note, we'll be back after a short break. Welcome back. Our last segment is something we call Spin This. In this segment, we spin a little wheel app. It lands on a topic, and our guests have to speak about it. Our topics this week are Ann Coulter cancels speech at Berkeley. The French election, should the government be run like a business, Trump's one-page tax plan, and Jeff Sessions on local police violence, see Texas, South Carolina, and Louisiana. Who would like to go first?
I will go first.
All right, here we go.
All right, let's do it.
You have Ann Coulter cancels speech at Berkeley.
Oh my God. Okay. So this is very complicated about censoring free speech on college campuses. I mean, I feel like college kids are a little too sensitive these days, honestly. I mean, it's okay to be offended, but it's not okay to threaten violence or to try and remove the offending speech from your campus. I mean, they're totally within their rights to protest the speech, but they should not make her or any students that agree with her feel unsafe or unwelcome college campuses are supposed to be a place where you're exposed to new ideas. It's not supposed to be a safe space. It's supposed to be an intellectually unsafe space. That's the only way you're going to be able to expand your mind. And that's the only way you're going to be able to really know if what you believe in is something worth believing in. And if you have to remove the offending speech from campus, then it really says something about your own beliefs, and it says something about how fragile you are.
Excellent. Thank you. Who's next?
I'll go next.
You have the French elections.
Okay. I don't really know that much about the French elections, honestly, besides the fact that there are some parallels to our election, our 2016 election, I guess I should say. So as far as that goes, I definitely think it's something to... I think the main reason that it should be important to people is kind of to see how the relations... I know that there's some talk about exiting the European Union and doing some things like London just did, and I think as far as the grand scheme of things goes, those type of relationships can affect people everywhere. As far as the candidates go, I don't know much about them besides the one lady who's running.
Marine Le Pen.
Yes, Marine Le Pen. That's pretty much the main one, but I just think it's ironic that she's stealing the shine of that election, as I feel like Trump kind of stole the shine of this election, and I think it's important that other people be highlighted, I guess I'll say. But that's really all I know.
All right, excellent. Thank you.
I'll go next.
Should the government be run like a business?
No. Business's role is to help people make money, or to make money in general, not necessarily help people make money. Government's role, at least in my own personal views, is to help people, and that's that, not to make money.
Fair enough. All right, Haley?
Yep.
Jeff Sessions on local police violence.
I don't have an update on this. I know that he was talking about not reviewing local police departments as heavily in terms of misuse of force and things like that. I don't know about the states that you mentioned in particular. I know there have been like some recent incidences, and I'm not sure what his response is going to be. I assume it will be very different than what we would have gotten in the last administration, because they've really changed the tone of how we deal with those kind of situations with police departments has changed a lot with this administration. So I don't think that we're going to see maybe the same kind of response that we would have seen or would hope to see from the last administration with this.
Excellent. And the last topic will go to me, which is Trump's one-page tax plan. From the title, you can see is a one-page tax plan. This is obviously not a tax plan. It is several bullet points. The last one is in a different font size as the rest of them. Honestly, an extra hour just for copy editing would have been good. But on additionally, the last note is have listening sessions to hear what people have to say on tax reform. This is in no way tax plan. It's no way tax reform. It is broad, sweeping ideas that are all very traditional Republican ideas. Nothing here is new, and nothing here is very concrete, as we see in general with the Trump administration. All right. Thank you all for listening. This was another episode of the Trachtenberg Wonkcast. I am Nathan Rupp.
Adam Brooks.
Elizabeth Moorhead.
Thomas Coyne. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And Haley Dunn.
All right, see y'all next week.
This show is edited by Nathan Rupp, produced by Haley Dunn, and music by Pelly Gunther.